afternoon in Los Angeles Harbor.
That was a clip from movie mogul Howard Hughes' historic flight of his giant flying boat, Spruce Goose. Speaking of Howard Hughes, you might be familiar with the hit podcast, You Must Remember This. It explores the secret and forgotten histories of the early days of Hollywood. Karina Longworth is the creator and host of the show, and she's also the author of Seduction, Sex, Lies, and Stardom in Howard Hughes' Hollywood.
Well, the period that Hughes was active in Hollywood is basically the mid-1920s through the end of the 1950s. And that's almost exactly what historians refer to as the classical Hollywood era. So that's when the studio system is at its peak. And during that time, you have the entire evolution of the first wave of Hollywood and of the studio system. You have the transition from silent film to sound. You have the establishment of a censorship board and then the collapse of that censorship board. You have the Hollywood blacklist, which comes about in the late 40s and early 1950s, where the studios, under pressure from government forces, make a big deal about expelling supposed communists from the industry. And Howard Hughes is involved in all of these things.
You say that in his films, Hughes commodified male desire more blatantly than any mainstream filmmaker of his time, and in turn helped produce an incredibly influential sexualized image of womanhood that has impacted American culture ever since. Can you give me an example of one of the ways he did this early on in his movie-making career?
Sure. It's not like he invented the idea of women being sexy in movies. I think that one of the reasons why cinema caught on as it did is this voyeuristic thing that both men and women can have in the audience of looking at beautiful people. That's an exciting thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
But up to the point where Howard Hughes is making his first directorial effort, Hell's Angels, which he's making in the late 1920s and was released in 1930, the sort of manipulation of the audience's desires was relatively classy, generally. I mean, there was some small glimpses of nudity in films, but generally it was artistically done. With this film, Hell's Angels, Howard Hughes built much of the film, but the entirety of the marketing campaign around the promise of looking at Jean Harlow's scantily clad body. So he designs this gown for her to wear in the film, and it's a film set during World War I and is supposedly about fighter pilots. But he designs this gown for her to wear that is completely threadbare. In black and white film, it appears to be the same color of her skin. It's totally backless. And he sets this climactic scene around her wearing it and dancing with one of the male characters. And he just shoots her with her bosoms heaving.
With Hell's Angels, Howard Hughes began the tradition of making stars of unknowns.
Would you be shocked if I put on something more comfortable?
After appearing in Hell's Angels, Jean Harlow became the platinum blonde sex symbol of the 1930s and a Hollywood superstar.
And then the entirety of the marketing campaign, again, for this movie that's ostensibly a war movie about fighter pilots, and for which most people would say that the creative value of the movie is in these aviation scenes, the entire marketing campaign is based around the image of Jean Harlow's body. So you have these posters where there's a huge painting of her sort of like leaning back in a dress that is falling off of her and teeny tiny images of airplanes all around her.
Hmm.
So he's selling the body. He's selling the female body, even though that's not what the movie is even about.
Hell's Angels, directed by Howard Hughes, a motion picture for all time.
You mentioned this marketing campaign, which was totally focused on Jean Harlow and in particular her chest. Was there any controversy about the marketing campaign at the time it came out?
Certainly it was unusual. And I think the pushback came more from the industry itself than anyone else. And this would be a pattern that Hughes would see throughout his career. All of the other studios, all of the other producers and marketers had been playing by the same kinds of rules and had, you know, sort of been keeping the promotion of sexuality in line because there had been so much criticism in the 1920s of Hollywood as being this cesspool with all of these scandals. And then Hughes completely disregarded that and just did what he knew would sell. And so that frustrates the people who are restraining themselves from doing that kind of marketing.
Yes, the outlaw is coming.
In 1941, Howard Hughes started working on a Western movie called The Outlaw, which was Jane Russell's debut. Originally, there was a different director. Howard Hawks was directing it, but Hughes fired him and took over as director. Why did Howard Hughes fire Hawks?
Well, according to internal memos, it was because Hughes didn't like the footage that was coming back from the first couple of weeks of shooting. My theory of reading everything about the production of this film was that Hughes was impatient because Hawks had not shot with Jane Russell yet. She had been off doing publicity photo shoots while Hawks worked with the male actors. And I think Hughes really felt like the value of the movie that he knew how to promote was this beautiful young woman with heaving breasts. And he was impatient to see footage of her.
More excitement and thrills than has ever been in one picture before. And yet it is unlike anything you have ever seen. At last, the screen has dared to tell the story of the outlaw.
Didn't he do something to make Jane Russell's breasts even more prominent in the film?
It's become legend that he designed a bra for her to wear in the film, and he did design a bra, but according to Jane Russell, she tried it on and felt that it was uncomfortable and ridiculous. And so what she did was she took it off, put her old bra back on, and covered the seams of the bra with Kleenex, and then put her costume on, and Hughes couldn't tell the difference.
So by this time, there was a censorship board, right?
Well, there was a censorship board in the late 1920s that only became effective in 1934.
So how did the censorship board react to Hughes's focus on Jane Russell's breasts in The Outlaw?
I think Hughes successfully sold the idea that The Outlaw was a movie that the censors didn't want you to see that was too sexy. Uh-huh. But in fact, when he finished the film, he submitted it to the censorship board, and they gave it their seal of approval. What they objected to was the marketing of the film. Hughes was doing things to market this film that had never been done before. He sent a blimp over Los Angeles shaped like a breast. He had a skywriters draw two circles with dots in the air. And under it, it said, "The outlaw is coming." There were newspaper ads in which there were cartoons of a man pinning down Jane Russell, which is essentially the rape scene that's in the film. And there were drawings of Jane Russell in newspaper ads where it looked like she was wearing no shirt. So it was this kind of thing that the censors pushed back on.
As you mentioned, there's a controversial rape scene in the film. And let me take a moment to offer a quick trigger warning to our listeners. Can you tell me about this scene?
Yeah, so The Outlaw tells the story of Billy the Kid, and near the beginning of the movie, he meets this young woman played by Jane Russell. Her character's name is Rio, and Rio knows that Billy the Kid killed her brother, and so she tries to attack him with a pitchfork, and Billy the Kid pins her down, gets rid of the pitchfork, and as punishment for her coming at him with the pitchfork, he rapes her. And you don't see the sexual violence, but you can hear it. You know that he's thrown her down behind this block of hay, and he's pinning her down, and you hear her struggle.
Let me go!
Hold still, lady, or you won't have much dress left.
Let me go!
So it's very clear what's happening. But then it seems confused because for the rest of the movie, she's in love with him, and she's almost a hypnotic slave to him. It completely changes her personality in a way that is extremely unrealistic. And it makes it seem like what Hughes was trying to convey was that if you encounter a feisty, independent woman, you have to tame her.
I'm curious about how Hughes was able to get this rape scene past the censor. Is it because, as you said, you don't see the sexual violence, you just hear it? Is that why?
Well, certainly, because there's no visual, there's nothing to protest against. In memos between Hughes's screenwriter, Jules Firthman, and the members of the censorship board while the film was being made, they expressed concern about the scene in the script, and the screenwriter said, "But don't worry, you won't see any sex, only violence." And then they were placated by that.
Interesting. Jane Russell didn't have an affair with Howard Hughes, right?
I don't believe that they did, no, and I haven't seen any credible evidence that they did. She writes in her memoir of one night deep into their relationship, years after they first met, where she ended up spending the night at his house because I think she was too drunk to drive home, mm-hmm. and he tried to get in bed with her, and she just told him no, and that was it.
Despite the fact that apparently they didn't have an affair, Hughes's treatment of Russell must have done a lot of emotional and psychic damage to her.
certainly years after The Outlaws, she became very vocal about this feeling that she had, that she had been exploited by the film and by the marketing of the film. You know, she was a devout Christian, and she enjoyed being beautiful and she enjoyed being sexy, but she didn't enjoy feeling like her body was being put on display for men to ogle at. And it really was many years after she started filming The Outlaw before she was able to really show her full range of talents in a film. I mean, I cite Gentlemen Prefer Blondes, which she made in 1953, over a decade after finishing The Outlaw, as being the first film to really showcase everything that Jane Russell could do, from comedy to singing to dancing.
Hughes comes across as very manipulative and very unlikable in your book, but is there anything that you have any empathy for him?
Yeah, I mean, he died alone without anybody around who wasn't paid to be there. It's his fault.
Yeah, of
because
course. Because
he had pushed away, he had refused any kind of emotional intimacy and pushed away anybody who he could have had that with. But I think that, you know, I have a lot of empathy for somebody who dies in that situation.
You started writing Seduction before the Me Too movement and the Harvey Weinstein story made headlines. How do you see your book fitting into this current cultural moment that we're in right now?
I finished it, actually, before the Weinstein revelations came out. So, or at least I finished the first draft. So I don't see it as a Me Too book at all. It's not influenced by that movement. This is history. You know, this is stuff that happened a long time ago. If anything, I see parallels not between Howard Hughes and Harvey Weinstein or any of those people, but between Howard Hughes and Donald Trump. I mean, I see them both as these master manipulators of the media who consistently tell lies and pretend that they're not, pretend that they're truth tellers, pretend that they're rebels, even though they're completely corporate manipulators. And their attitudes to women, you know, are somewhat similar in that it seems very difficult for both of them to see women as human beings.
Karina Longworth is the author of Seduction: Sex, Lies, and Stardom in Howard Hughes's Hollywood. She's also the host of the hit podcast You Must Remember This, which is all about vintage Hollywood. Sounds like a song from a classic film, doesn't it? That title, very Casablanca-esque. Learn more about Karina at wpr.org/beta.
You know, one of the employees says, thankfully no one got hurt, but this was fraud. And Ja sort of responds that, no, this wasn't fraud. It wasn't fraud. It was false advertising.
Wisconsin filmmaker Chris Smith talks about his documentary Fire, the greatest party that never happened. That's coming up in just a moment. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta on Wisconsin Public Radio.